Jewish Latin Princess, Episode 18, Robin Sachs-Garboz, film writer, producer, and director.
You're listening to Jewish Latin Princess Podcast by Ya'el. Every week, get your dose of inspiration from the world's most uniquely talented Jewish women, and from Ya'el herself. Seeking profound and practical ways to live a joyful, richer Jewish life? Welcome to Jewish Latin Princess Podcast. And now, Jewish lifestyle expert and bilingual blogger at JewishLatinPrincess.com, your host, Ya'el.
You're listening to Jewish Latin Princess, everyone. Welcome back. I'm Ya'el Trush, your host. We are well over the 4,000 downloads mark, and for that, I thank you. And for all the wonderful reviews you've been leaving on iTunes, keep reviewing, ladies. That's how iTunes is going to get the hint that this is one of the most relevant shows for a Jewish audience and puts us at the top of their chart. Yes, that's how the show gets recommended to listeners. It's kind of an SEO game, and you can help me play that game as a Jewish content creator, both on the podcast space as well as on the blogging space. Speaking of blog, have you gone into the blog, JewishLatinPrincess.com? Have you subscribed? Go ahead and subscribe. What are you waiting for? I have a really nice fashion giveaway going on right now. You really don't want to miss it. Plus, there's a lot of good content in there and more to come. I'm so happy to have you all around, and thank you again for your continued support. And here we are today on episode 18. Hi, that's another cause for celebration. And to help me celebrate today, I have a woman with an incredible energy. But before I introduce her, let me tell you, I love a good film and good theater. I actually used to act in college. I married an actor. Yes, my husband was an actor, although when we met, he wasn't an actor anymore. But I definitely have an affinity for the world of performing arts. And today's guest knows the film, TV, and theater business in and out and is using her vast and top-notch experience to bring high-caliber productions to the Jewish world. My guest today is Robin Sachs-Garboz. She has over 30 years' experience as a director, writer, and producer. Garboz's feature films, A Light for Grey Towers, The Heart That Sings, and Operation Candlelight, have garnered international press acclaim and have been official selections at the Jerusalem Jewish Film Festival, Atlanta Jewish Film Festival, and the Ashkelon Jewish Eye Film Festival. Garboz and her writing partner husband, Levi Yitzhak, are in pre-production on a new film, Meet the Schustermans, a dramedy, which will be Garboz's first general audience feature. A graduate of Brand University, Garboz has also directed over 40 plays in New York and Los Angeles and worked with much noted actors and directors. Her television credits include Head of the Class and America's Most Wanted. She's the founder of Kol Neshama Conservatory of the Performing Arts, where she trains and mentors young Jewish women who are looking to develop their artistic voice. Here we go, ladies. Robin Sachs-Garboz. Robin Sachs-Garboz, welcome to Jewish Latin Princess.
Thank you so much. Wonderful to be here.
Such a pleasure. Such a pleasure. I want to set the stage a little bit for listeners to get us in your journey before we talk about your current work, your work today, because I understand that you had a thriving career in the theater industry. You were also involved in TV writing and production, a graduate of Brown University. I mean, you were really playing it big. You were in LA and New York working. And yet there came a point, and I want to know what happened. What's that point when you started looking into your Jewish heritage? And as you start to look, perhaps you even started to think, to look at your career from a Jewish lens. So take us down memory lane a little bit, that path.
Sure, and it's a kind of interesting timing as I just returned from my 35th college reunion at Brown in Providence.
Wow.
And Shabbat at the now existing Brown Chabad House, and it was such an amazing experience of sort of old world meets new world synthesis, and just a wonderfully liberating moment in my life.
Wow.
You know, often people, when I've done interviews before, people always want to tell my story that, like, I gave up my big Hollywood career to become a Baal Tshuva. It's just simply not my narrative. I would say this, is that I grew up conservative. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a home with a strong, you know, Jewish Zionist identity, but it wasn't, but God wasn't part of, you know, the picture. Mm-hmm. And I was a lifelong spiritual seeker, and I knew that something existed in Judaism that I just couldn't access. I had tasted it in the books of Elie Wiesel and Chaim Potok, but I couldn't find it in, you know, in my world. So I explored lots of other, you know, Eastern ideas, meditation, creative visualization, past life regressions, you know,
wow.
like New Age,
yes.
Ideologies. And I found some very, very beautiful teachings. But with everything, I just felt that it just didn't sustain. Simultaneously, I had been a theater major at Brown and, you know, was this sort of racehorse out of the gates. Like, as soon as I graduated, I went to New York, had a job working for an off-Broadway theater, began directing right away, and spent the 80s just completely living, breathing, immersed in the world of New York theater.
Mm-hmm.
My mentor, I had assisted some very prominent directors, and my mentor, Barnett Kelman, was a of the theater directors in New York. He was the first to go into television, and he became one of the top sitcom directors in the business. He did all of Murphy Brown, Mad About You, etc. Mm-hmm. And through him, I really began to learn. I spent years observing on TV sets, learning about the camera and how to direct television. In 1990, I got my first sort of big break in TV, and I was, you know, one of the youngest and one of the few women in a very male-dominated part of the business.
Right.
And I directed a show called Head of the Class, which some of your listeners may remember.
I remember it.
and it was, you know, it was, and at the same time, I, you know, my spiritual yearning was growing. And I would say there were two ideas that I was stuck on that really catapulted me into like the next phase. One of the things that really troubled me about the industry is that, like, when they loved me, I was happy. When the reviews were great, I was thrilled. When I received, you know, criticism or problems, I was depressed. And I came to this realization that, like, why am I putting my happiness in the hands of these people? Who are they to determine whether I'm up or down?
Wow.
And there must be something beyond, something that transcends this, which I knew was God. That was the only way at the time that I could express it. And so I turned to God at that time. Literally, I sat down on my couch one day and I said, if I could make a movie about anything in the world, what's the most important thing to me? And the first thing that came up was Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
And this story just started to come. It was like one of these mystical channeling experiences, creative experiences,
right,
where I just was open. I had turned and asked the question, and it came. And this whole idea for a script, you know, just sort of overwhelmed me, and I ended up partnering with a woman who was a phenomenal writer who I worked with at New York Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
We wrote this screenplay called The Spark, which was one of six scripts chosen out of 1,000 submissions to go to the Sundance Institute Writers Lab.
Wow.
Which was amazing. But at that time, I became like obsessed with everything Jewish. I couldn't get enough. I was like, you know, I was researching and I was interviewing Holocaust survivors for the project. And this is pre-Schindler's List. So there was very little that had come out into the mainstream that even discussed the Holocaust.
Wow.
All of these incredible teachers, really, people who had seen the unspeakable. And I knew that they had something to teach me. And I was just like a sponge. And then I met a woman who took me to my first class in Chassidus. It was Breslov Chassidus. And when I got there, and the teacher read a story of Rabbi Nachman's and then began to speak and teach Chassidus, I went, okay.
This is it.
Exactly. This is everything I have been craving and looking for my entire life. And here it is in my own backyard. And a few years later, I found out that my maternal grandmother actually was born in Uman.
No way.
Yeah. We love this Hashgacha Pratis, this divine providence. And she actually used to play as a little girl in Sophia Park, where Rabbi Nachman did his bodidus, his great teaching of meditation.
I'm getting chills.
So I had shot my first episode for head of the class. Uh-huh. And between the time that I shot it and it aired, I started keeping Shabbos.
Ooh, so how did that go?
Well, not too well. Yes, it went great on the spiritual end of things, but it was a huge challenge in my career. I'd become a member of the Directors Guild. I had an agent who was, you know, really excited about me, and suddenly I couldn't work on Friday night. Basically, 80% of the sitcom shot on Friday night, or if they didn't shoot on a Friday night, they would not guarantee that you could get out on those early winter Shabbosim, so nobody would hire me, and my sitcom career died a quick death.
Wow. What a challenge for you.
It was really, really challenging. And there was no role model at the time. There was nobody doing Shabbos dinner at Sundance. I went to Sundance alone and kept Shabbos. Like, everybody was out going to parties and movies, and I was, you know, with my little, you know, bottle of grape juice and Shabbos candles by myself. And it was really, really, really hard and lonely. But I knew it was MS. I knew that it was truth. And, you know, as it says, you know, when one door closes, another door opens.
Correct.
And I was at Sundance, and I really had, in a very deep way, taken that leap of faith. And I really, you know, my artistic sense did not really resonate with sitcoms. Like, it's not really what I wanted to put out into the world. The money was like crazy amazing. Mm-hmm. I just didn't believe in the message, mm-hmm. and the material. And so as I had grown up in Massachusetts, and I was an expert skier. And when I was going up the chairlift at Sundance, I happened to go up with I happened to ride with one of the producers of America's Most Wanted, and he was out there scouting for new directors. And here I was, you know, at Sundance with a screenplay. I'd had, you know, big theater director. I had directed head of the class. And I was female, and they had no women directors on their staff. So I was exactly what he was looking for. And I got the job. And I mean, after he saw me ski, actually.
Did you tell him on the lift that you were Shomer Shabbat?
I didn't go right into it. But he was a really special person. And the actual producer who I directly worked with is a Jewish guy named Greg Klein, who just, you know, that show was really respectful. Like, I, you know, Hashem brought me right to the correct place, and they were willing to work around my Shabbos schedule. They were an enumptive schedule. I had kosher food on the set, and I was helping capture these fugitives, which was like doing a mitzvah. You know, for somebody to get on America's Most Wanted, they had to, like, you know, they were sure that these guys were, or women were, guilty. They had jump bail. You know, they had escaped prison. They had, you know, managed to flee the law. And so, and the other thing was that other, you know, sitcoms are multi-camera, you know, very theatrical style of filmmaking. And right. America's Most Wanted was single camera, shot on film. So for me, it was like getting to go to film school. And all the pieces of my, you know, education that I was missing, I got through the show. I worked with phenomenal cinematographers. And so over the next 8 years, you know, I did several segments for them, and they, and you know, and each one was like a short film. It was like getting to do 40 short films, and so it was really the place that I think I became a filmmaker. And it was a fantastic opportunity.
Wow, wow! And then, so what happens next? At what point do you go on your own, and you start thinking about establishing a camp called Neshama? What exactly happens after?
So, I was still single, and you know, really, really needing and wanting to get married and start my family. And I would say that I have a sideline. I would say I'm an expert at the dating process, and I love to make shidduchim because it also taps into my ability as a casting director. but I finally, thank God, after many, many amazing, you know, dating experiences, met my husband to be when I was 38. And while during our engagement process, we were having, you know, Shabbos lunches at various homes. And I met these two young women in particular, Rivka Siegel, who is now Rivka Siegel Krinsky, mm-hmm. Who was in eighth grade, and Chayala Fogelman, who was in sixth grade. And Chayala sang to me at a Shabbos table, and this girl had a voice that was out of this world, like a serious major talent. And then Rivka Siegel invited me to her eighth grade play, and I saw a budding actress who was really on a high level, the real thing. And I realized these girls would hear what I did, and I saw the sparkle in their eyes that would light up. And I realized that they had a yearning, and there was nothing at the time, this is in 1999, available. There were no opportunities for serious artistic development. And I had been given every opportunity. I studied at an English drama school. I went to Stage Door Manor, which is like the premier, you know, drama camp where, you know, I was in Oliver with Robert Downey Jr. Like everybody who I went to Stage Door with, so many of them came out and had, you know, had huge careers subsequently. And you know, and I had also directed a number of plays at Juilliard, as well as other drama schools like NYU. So I was deeply familiar with the conservatory paradigm. Mm-hmm. I said, I have to do something for these girls. Like, there is a need, and I'm here to fulfill it. And so the summer after I got married, summer 2000, we launched what became Kol Neshama Performing Arts Conservatory. And it was really structured with classes in singing and dance and acting, high level for girls who wanted to immerse. But the entire program was also infused with a Torah perspective in every aspect of the curriculum. And, you know, somebody asked me, oh, why don't you just do a Jewish, The Sound of Music? And like, I was really insulted by that because I just said, you don't understand. This is, we have a voice here, and I am about nurturing and empowering this voice to emerge. And we have so much incredible material that needs to be given a form. And so we only did original works that were all, you know, completely from Jewish sources. And that's really where it began. And by our third summer, one of my students gave me the young adult novel for A Light for Grey Towers. And I said, oh my goodness, this is a movie. This is like, you know, a little princess meets Oliver, meets Annie. And my husband also, through my husband, Levi Yitzchak, through being married to me, also was able to really actualize his great talent as a songwriter.
And
a writer. We also write together. He's great with dialogue. You know, I'm great with structure and storytelling, and he's just, you know, brilliant with dialogue. And he's just an incredible songwriter. And so we did the play version of A Light for Grey Towers, and he wrote the entire score. And then I had the idea to turn this into, you know, a feature movie musical. And that was the next big, huge, insurmountable challenge. But we did persevere, and, you know, it was this, you know, incredible, groundbreaking success. And we, you know, Baruch Hashem, and we, but we did risk everything to make this movie. We put our whole entire lives, our, you know, every drop of our money.
Oh my goodness.
On the line.
Spoken like a true entrepreneur.
I mean, you know, some people, I'm not necessarily recommending it. You have to have a pretty, you know,
tough skin.
Yeah, you have to have a tough skin to weather that. But I also, I had enough, there was enough synchronicity, there were enough, you know, clues, I mean, just sort of signs from Hashem that we were doing the right thing. And it was really, really hard, but so is giving birth. And you know, the creative process demands that of you, I think. And you have to look at the creative process as a birth process.
Absolutely.
So, right?
Absolutely. You know what? When I hear you, so many things are popping through my head. So many ideas. First of all, God does not give anybody a challenge that they cannot handle. And, you know, you went through your challenges and you know, you succeeded. And, you know, and in our lives, whatever path we've had to travel, it is just really divinely ordained. You were meant to go through all that training, to be born to the family that you were born, all of that to bring it to this point. It's like God guided, like it was just that which you were chosen for, this role of really creating this niche that was so needed for Jewish women, and infusing the arts, the performing arts, with this Torah perspective. I mean, it's like, wow, you know?
And if absolutely, and it, you know, you just simply have to open up to it. You have to just say, "Show me, Hashem, and I'm there, and I'm going to show up for you." And of course, He shows up for us. And and it was also infusing it with a Torah perspective, but it was also bringing a sort of quest for excellence, that true professionalism,
exactly.
Into the religious community, which is filled with talent, you know, and but, you know, there was a lot of fear around it, and it's which is completely understandable, because you just look at popular culture and you see how much of it does not resonate
with
Jewish values. But you see, and now, you know, there's so much more to say about the journey. But just to say one thing about now is, I feel like my job has been in reach and outreach. The in reach was to bring these ideas, this craft, this, you know, perspective into the religious world in a way that honors halacha and religious values.
Right.
And also now to bring the ideas, the values, the stories of our people out to the world, because there have been so few authentic Jewish characters in popular culture. It's like, I cringe every time I see a movie where they try to pick an Orthodox Jew. It's always some bogus stereotype that doesn't even begin to touch upon who a God-fearing Jew
is. Absolutely. So yeah, that's
that's the next horizon.
That's the next,
you know, step.
Yeah. And it's just amazing that God has definitely, you know, put you to this big task. But you're the woman to do it. So before we, you mentioned challenges, and I want to touch on that a little bit. But first, I picked up on something. I'm thinking, like, Robin is, helping young girls and mentoring them and doing all this. I mean, it takes a special kind of person to work with the younger generation and channel all that youthful energy. I mean, did you know you had that in you?
Interesting. You know, I guess maybe I feel that I have a Kesher with teenage girls and young women. I feel so connected.
You must. You've been doing this for many, many years successfully.
Thank you. Yeah, you know, I feel that I'm still so connected. I had gone to prep school before Brown. I went to prep school for 6 years. And it's interesting. I love Facebook because there's an aspect of social media that really is so important to me. It's really allowed me to connect, to reconnect with people from every aspect of my very diverse, experiences in life. Right. And I love all my friends from prep school and from Brown. And I love, it's just that time in my own life is still so much a part of who I am. And it's such a formative time in all of our lives. And so one of the things that I find with teenagers is I just love that they haven't become cynical yet, that still open-minded, and you can really you can truly impact them in such profound ways. But I feel that, I don't know, you know, honestly, I love working with women. I also have been, the last 2.5 years, I've been teaching acting at the Chabad Treatment Center to guys who are, from 20 to 40 who are in recovery. And it's kind of like drama therapy.
Wow.
That's also been just phenomenal, absolutely a phenomenal experience for me. So I think that I think I'm growing. I think when I started Kol Neshama, it took me, I'm in such a different place today. I think that I had to learn or relearn about working with teenage girls and from girls and what their particular issues and struggles are. And I feel that with each group that I work with. And I think that the real essence of what I am bringing or love to teach is just opening creative channels in everyone to really open people up to their own creative expression. It changes with each age is different, and it has to be sort of age appropriate. It has to be adjusted to different ages. I love, like, 16-year-old, 17, 18, 19, 20, that's when it's
so
really
special.
Fun.
So special.
Go ahead.
So let me ask you, when you mentioned a light for gray towers, you talk about, you mentioned the word challenges, and and I'm assuming it was a musical, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So some of our listeners might not have experience with the nuances of Jewish orthodoxy. Could you tell us a little bit about, you know, some of the things that someone in your position has to take into account when producing films, musicals with female performers? What kind of challenges are specific to this niche?
Okay. There are several, and I know my audience. And I really respect my audience, and it's just, you know, it's just a primary piece. First and foremost is tznius, is modesty.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I want my audience to be as broad as possible. I want to be able to play to as many people as I can, but I know that my loyal audience are from people who don't see non-Jewish films, you know, really for the many of whom prior to A Life for Grey Towers had never seen a movie before.
Right.
Certainly never gone to a movie theater. And so when I made A Life for Grey Towers, we shot on film and then I mastered on HD. And this was like just at the beginning of HD, high definition. Mm-hmm. I was insistent because I am, you know, as a filmmaker, you put all this effort into something. I would not let it be screened on standard definition. So I hired a company called Rooftop Films to make sure that we were screening HD, and I wanted to give my audience a real movie-going experience. So first of all, the modesty requirements. Mm-hmm. It really means, like, you have to understand the tsnius of Williamsburg. You know, you have to know we're talking collarbones, elbows, knees have to be, everything has to be like 100% sneeze.
Right.
This is a big challenge. What happens when, you know, one girl in the dance sequence, like her skirt was above her knees and you didn't realize it when you were filming because you were doing 50 million other things.
Right.
I've had to go into VFX, which is video effects post-production, and lengthen skirts. And it's not just the simple Photoshop.
Wow.
Moving pictures, and it costs like thousands of dollars. It's insane. And I've had to do that because I know that my audience requires that.
Right.
So what I felt, what was great about A Life for Grey Towers is that it's set in Victorian England. It's a period piece. So, like, no problem there. Like, everybody dressed modestly in those times, you know.
Right, but I was going to say, if you have a character, you know, like in Operation Candlelight, I mean, you pulled it off so well, but I could imagine that would have been challenging.
Indeed. Well, so there we had, Operation Candlelight was the first of the three films. It was the one that is set in modern times, mm-hmm. contemporary. And we have the character of Stella, who's Jewish but not religious at all.
Right.
So the first thing I thought about, how do I solve this problem? And I decided to set it in the winter in California, in sweater weather. And that's why it's Hanukkah play, because we could dress her in a way that you know, is completely believable and yet speak in code to my frum audience, who knows that we're not seeing her knees, collarbones, or elbows. And so we have her, you know, so we had her, we ombre'd her hair, we gave her multiple piercings, you know, but she wears this like funky, she wears these funky clothes that like suggest she's wearing pants. We gave her a hot pink, you know, shirt underneath this like really funky coat that happens to cover her knees with her, you know, leggings underneath.
Right.
And so nobody like who's not religious would know that this girl is really, you know, that we're doing this for our firm audience. She's completely believable as a secular Jewish character. And yet at the same time, that's how we manage the problem.
Right.
You know, I love period pieces because you just avoid all the tsnius stuff and, you know, altogether. And I love also uniforms.
Right. You did that in Operation Candlelight, and that was helpful.
I did it in all three films, in The Heart That Sings and A Life for Grey Towers as well, because you know what? It saves so much trouble.
Right.
And so that's the thing with also, I think, making movies for this audience. Where do you have, for me also, this is the other huge challenge, is, you know, a movie is different from a play. In a play, you can have girls dressed up as boys, and it's cute. It's actually very reverse Shakespearean,
right.
You know, where the men dressed up as women. And it's cute. It's theatrical. It's fun. You know, Peter Pan, we're used to it. But on a film is something that's much more naturalistic. It's reality. And so you can't get away with it. It becomes weird. You know that that woman is, especially in these days with all the gender issues, you know, you definitely, you know, can't, it's just not realistic.
Right.
I've seen some of these from filmmakers try and create a world that's all women. And suddenly, you know, you're walking down the streets of Borough Park and you're only seeing women on the street and you go, what bizarre planet did I land on?
Right.
You know? So I knew that if I was spending the kind of money that we were spending, I mean, our budgets, you know, are in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And, you know, that we do want to be able to play to a non-religious audience, that we had to make a real movie. And so that was another, that was a big issue. And I ended up, beginning with A Light for Grey Towers, I used the male characters, I did them very carefully, and I did them under, you know, the sort of halachic guidance of a rabbi.
Wow.
I had scenes where there were either two men. I rewrote in the book, the ladies Beamish are actually a husband and wife, and I made them two sisters. Mm-hmm. And I sort of was inspired by the movie Twins to have them be two, you know, not identical twin sisters. And I thought that was really, you know, a sort of funny gag. And in the scene where there is a, between the husband and wife, I shot that scene very carefully where they were never actually in the same frame at the same time, you know, which I used all the illusions of filmmaking
very
so that
he
was, when we were filming it, he was actually looking up at a window and she was actually looking down at a ladder. But in the movie, it's like, you know, this beautiful scene between a husband and wife.
Wow. Very interesting.
And you know, it was hard because initially I did have a big controversy in Borough Park, mm-hmm. For having real men in the film. Mm-hmm. But we survived it. And, you know, since I have, you know, there's now a thing amongst from women, like, you know, is this a, like they see a professional movie has men, it doesn't cast women dressed up as men.
Right.
So they don't want something that's not professional.
Right.
They want something that's high level. And
right.
So, you know, I've spoken with, I speak to rabbis, I ask questions, and so that's how we resolve that issue.
It's beautiful. Talk to us about the challenge of money. You mentioned money already. It's a big deal. Your productions are high caliber. They cost a lot of money. How do you handle the fundraising and all that?
That's the biggest part, honestly. That is number one challenge. It's nothing else. I have so much great material, so many movies I want to make. You know, I think the biggest challenge within the women's market is that, you know, women, religious women, are oftentimes defer to their husbands to write the checks, and the husbands don't see the films. So we're like, you know, this sort of idea of performing arts, cinema, movies for Jewish women. It's just not even on the radar. Mm. And then on the other side, you get these Jewish foundations who hear the for women only thing, and they're, you know, they're pluralistic and they don't like the idea and they don't want to support that. So that's, you know, that's the toughest part. I would say where I'm at now, we went into debt over it. We borrowed, we did have some we found a few out-of-the-box donors who really got what we were doing and loved it and appreciated it and helped us along the way. And to them, I'm so grateful.
Wow.
But we are, you know, I made these three films through Kol Neshama, which is a 501c3 nonprofit organization.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I did get a few grants. We did get a grant from the Jewish Community Foundation for A Life for Grey Towers. And what I realized is that the real way is to work to become, to develop a business model that is profitable, is self-generating. And
right.
Thank God our movies have now, you know, been in several, have played all over the world. I do have an international fan base of about 300,000 women and girls. Our DVDs are still in worldwide distribution, and we go through continual replications of them. And there is, through our distributors, mostly music, they have an online rental, like a kosher Hulu.
Yes, yes.
So we get monthly royalties from that, which is, you know, so we're almost, we have made the money back. Which is great. We've basically made about $1 million in our, DVD and online sales. I mean, that doesn't put us in profits. I mean,
right.
Through everything, it's like, we're just about, we're very, very close to being in the black. And I see that's where we're going. I think that by the time I got to, you know, I became a better filmmaker by the time I got to Operation Candlelight. And so I know where I can cut costs now.
Right.
And I just know it better. And I think that there were some things along the way, you know, I had with the distribution where we, you know, whatever, we didn't see as much of our profit as we should have, but I've just become a much savvier business person.
Right.
And I feel that if I were to give any advice to young creatives, you know, is to simultaneously develop as, you know, learn the business side as well, because that's going to really, really empower all the possibilities.
Yeah,
I had to learn it the hard way, you know, in some circumstances,
right,
but
right.
I, you know, so we are tuition based, like a part of the summer tuition of our program goes towards production. I know that I'm going to make a certain amount with our distribution. And you know, I see it all. I see the future as profit.
Yay.
Yeah. Thank God. Yeah.
I see it too. I see it too, Robin. So now that we're talking about business, and I look at your career and I look at your profile and I see success in so many levels. You've become a savvy businesswoman. You're an expert in your field. You're a wife. You're a mother. You're a mentor to young girls. You're an educator. You're using your God-given talents to its utmost capacity, not just for yourself, but the service of others. I mean, it's just really unbelievable. It reminds me that success is so multifaceted. It's something's very hard to define. Do you ever think about success, and you know, how do you measure it? Like, how do you define it even?
Well, I would definitely, that's so interesting. That's an interesting question. You know, I think that it is about actualizing all of one's potential.
Right.
It is definitely about giving back and giving as well. I think that has to be a part of true success.
Absolutely.
For me, I'm so fortunate in the work that I do that I get to see game changing, like literally before my eyes.
Wow.
I will be teaching a class, for instance, at the treatment center, and I see a guy get up there who's on stage, who's never acted in his life, but you know he's got all of this untapped potential, have just a breakthrough experience, like be brilliant, and then get all of this, know it, have this like go, wow, that was really cool.
Right.
And then have all of this sort of positive feedback, and you see in front of your eyes somebody's life transform. And I can just go, I could write a book about this. Honestly, I've seen it in so many different scenarios. And I really feel that unlocking creativity in others who then go on to create is so, that is an incredible measure of success.
Wow.
And you know, I look at somebody like Leah Gottfried.
We're big fans.
Exactly. And, you know, and it's just so wonderful because I've had so many students along the way that, you know, it's just a question. It's an empowerment and it's an encouragement and it's a providing them with the craft that they're craving. And then you see them go off with, you know, courage to create.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's such a Torah concept that when we are in the act of creating, of creativity, mm-hmm. we are imitating our creator.
Yes.
We are aligning ourselves with our creator. So it is really, you know, a holy act. And I think that for me, the next big measure of success, now it has to be financial. It's just that
right.
that has to be a piece of it. And it's getting there, and people are starting to take note. You know, we have this demographic that's been underserved that is, you know, profit, that is real, is a real niche market.
Right.
And I am the trusted commodity in that niche market. And that is something of value. My next big film is going to be my first feature for general audiences.
Yay.
I'm excited. That's what I'm really, really, really excited about, and trying to keep my focus on that and, you know, making that happen. It's called Meet the Schustermans.
Okay.
And it's a dramedy about Mendy and Mushki Schusterman and their five children who are your sort of typical. Well, you know what? I'm not sure. I think I want to keep it. I may want to keep it under wraps.
Keep it on the wraps. And then when it's out, you'll come back to the show and tell us all about that. We'll talk all about Meet the Schustermans and how successful it's been.
Ezra Zazen, from your lips to the one above.
Exactly.
Amen.
Amen. So we're running a little bit short on time, but I want to touch on motherhood, because that's one of the big facets of your life. You're a mother of two children. Many of my listeners are mothers. I can't imagine it's an easy juggling act with the timing of filmmaking and production and then summers and camp. Like, how does it happen, Robin?
It's an interesting thing. You know, I would say that my departure from America's Most Wanted came when I became a mother, because I was very much an adherent of natural parenting,
right.
which meant nursing on demand, carrying my baby all the time. And they were very open to Shabbos, to Yontif, to Kashrus. But when it came to a nursing mother, that just did not jive.
Mm.
But I felt that when I created Kol Neshama, that it was really important that my students, and I think my mothers really loved this, that my students see that motherhood didn't stop me from doing anything. And I can remember nursing my baby and, like, you know, watching a run through and, you know, with the blanket over me, jumping up on stage with the baby attached to give notes, you know.
Right.
And I think that was something really great for the young women to see.
Very important.
And, you know, I happen to, we're like this, you know, like the Von Trapp family. We're like this family unit. My son is an aspiring cinematographer. My daughter, who's been in every film, is, you know, Hashem was good to me. He blessed me with a beautiful, talented daughter who just loves acting, singing, and dance, and especially on film. And so we sort of all travel together, and she's been a part of Kol Neshama her entire life.
That's so
literally
nice.
I was expecting her our first summer, and her name is Chaya Solika.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a play based on the Solika story when I was expecting her, and named our daughter Chaya Solika. So it was you know, we just are all involved together.
So beautiful.
Thank you.
So beautiful.
I don't know. I think that what I do is so much creating for our children. When I was just up at Brown and I was with fabulous shluchim there, Mendel and Chani Laufer, at the Brown Chabad house, you know, they have 9 Kenai Nahara children with one on the way, B'Shad Tova, and this really blew my mind. I got there, and their kids knew every line, every lyric from every movie and every video I've ever made.
That is awesome.
I spent hours with these kids, and like they had these questions. How did you do this? How did you do that? And they were just, they couldn't get enough of it. And, you know, that at the end of the day, you know, that really gives you the strength and inspiration to press on.
Yep. You're doing something right.
Yeah, thank God.
So you're doing something right. So you're obviously not just very passionate about your craft and your creativity, but you're also very passionate about your Yiddish God, your Judaism. How do you stay, you know, how did you find time to learn? What do you do in that regard to keep you going?
We talk about, in my home, you know, we are Chabadnikim, mm-hmm. and we talk about Chassidus all the time in our home. And for me, the Rebbe and the Rebbetzin are an endless source of inspiration. I think that the Lubavitcher Rebbe had such an expansive vision that I just relate to.
Right.
I just can constantly draw inspiration from his ideas, his teachings, and the life that he led.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, since I am dedicated to creating films and theater pieces that are rooted in Jewish content, the research I do for my work
is also for your soul.
It's also for my soul. And, you know, like Rabbi Nachman of Breslov said, there is no separation between our business life and our spiritual life.
That's right.
That every moment of our lives is a choice between do we choose the high road or not?
Right.
And so I see my life as art and my life as spirituality and my spirituality as art and my art as spirituality. It's all like one holistic experience.
Right. It's all one service of God. Beautiful. Beautiful. All right, Robin, let's have some fun here and do some JLP fill in the blanks. And this is a part of the show where I give you an open-ended sentence and you answer it with the first thing that comes to mind. You ready?
Okay. I'm ready.
All right. I am Robin Sachs-Garboz, and I feel most spiritual when?
When I am in nature and when I am in a deep creative exchange with an actor.
I like that. My favorite mitzvah, or one that I feel most connected to, is
Hachnasis Orchim.
Aww.
Which is hospitality to guests. I love opening my home to have a very diverse and eclectic Shabbos table.
I could see it. I want to come over. I could see it being
you're
so fun.
Anytime, please. It's
I'll have to stop by LA and make a visit.
Please. We would love that, Yael. Please.
All right. My fondest, sweetest Jewish memory is?
My fondest, sweetest Jewish memory is, oh, standing outside of Menorah Hall in Borough Park after a huge mob scene screening of A Light for Grey Towers, when all of these literally 1,000 very Hasidish women, all dressed, you know, in full Hasidish garb, streamed out with their shining faces and showering us with blessings and wishes.
Oh my gosh, that is so beautiful. So beautiful. Wow. When I give tzedakah, I like to give to?
Well, right now, my new tzedakah is Brown Chabad House.
Nice.
It's a huge challenge to be who they are and where they are. And I really discovered this is my Chabad House. And I want to help them continue to grow. And That's it right now.
Very beautiful. They weren't there when you were there, obviously, right?
They were not. Right. They were not.
I have the same experience. I went to Tufts University and there was no Chabad house then, but there is now.
And you see, just it's not easy in these times.
It's not easy.
You know, we're living in crazy times, and we have to. The work on college campuses is so critical because there's so much brainwashing that's antithetical to Torah values that is just, you know, pervasive on college campuses. And I feel that it's just such important, courageous work.
It is. Absolutely. All right. Finally, I am Robin Sachs-Garboz, and today I'm most grateful for
the Rebbe, who gave me really my life, led me to my husband, which led to the creation of my family, and showed me the way to truly be all that I am capable of being, and to not be afraid of any part of myself, to embrace it and use it in the service of bringing the light of God into the world.
Wow, Robin, you couldn't have put the Rebbe's work and what the Rebbe was about in better words. I mean, that you're absolutely right. It's amazing. Thank you so much for being with us. This was so inspiring and memorable. How do we learn more about Kol Neshama and keep up with your work, Robin?
Kolneshama.org. Beautiful. Is our website, mm-hmm. And it's spelled KolneShama.org. And hopefully, you know, you'll see headlines soon.
We will. And hopefully we'll have you back on the show to talk about your future success.
With great pleasure. It was really wonderful speaking with you today.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Thanks for listening to Jewish Latin Princess Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe on iTunes, leave a rating, and share the podcast with the Jewish women you love. To access today's show notes, ask Yael a question, or suggest a uniquely talented Jewish woman to be featured on the show, visit JewishLatinPrincess.com.